It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Rwanda marks 20 years since the genocide that devastated the country. Rebel-controlled Libyan ports are beginning to reopen. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. International leaders converged on Rwanda for today's ceremonies marking the 20th anniversary of a genocide that killed nearly 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus by ethnic Hutu militia. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon will take part as President Paul Kagame prepares to light a national flame of mourning to burn for 100 days, the length of time the genocide is said to have taken place. One nation not attending, France, which came under criticism Sunday by Rwandan officials for having played a direct role in the genocide. The Rwandan foreign minister said France wronged Kigali by being partially responsible. She said relations between the two countries cannot be repaired if Rwanda has to accept the French version of events. Paris has denied any responsibility for the genocide, saying the accusations go against the reconciliation process between the two countries. A government campaign has been launched to encourage reconciliation among Rwandans. The I Am Rwandan campaign involves schools, businesses, and government, as VOA's Gabe Joslow reports.
One of the campaign's main proponents, Member of Parliament Edouard Bamporiki, says the idea is to start a conversation about the ethnic roles created by the genocide while reaffirming a national unity.
We are not sure 100% that we are different because we are Hutu and Tutsis, but we are sure 100% that we are all Rwandan.
20 years ago, 800,000 people were killed in a countrywide campaign of violence orchestrated by extremist Hutu militias targeting ethnic Tutsis and some moderate Hutus. Ethnicity has been a sensitive topic since the genocide. Now, in villages and public institutions, people are addressing the issue openly in moderated discussions. The ruling RPF party came up with the ideology for the program, which was developed in youth groups across the country. Participation is officially voluntary. But opponents say the program unfairly expects Hutus to apologize on behalf of the perpetrators of the genocide, even if they themselves were not involved. The initiative is one of many Rwanda has employed to try to unite communities divided by one of the worst atrocities of the 20th century. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
Before arriving in Kigali, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon was in Bangui, where he appealed for greater and quicker international involvement to quell intercommunal violence that's killed hundreds and displaced nearly a million over the past year. And look reports.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told the CAR's acting parliament, the National Transition Council, that their country is in, quote, a state of anarchy.
La communauté internationale.
Mr. Ban said the international community failed the people of Rwanda 20 years ago and is at risk of not doing enough for the people of the CAR today. The UN leader noted that atrocious crimes are being committed in the CAR, including lynchings, decapitations, and sexual violence. He told the council that ethno-religious cleansing is a reality and that Muslims and Christians have been placed in mortal danger simply because of who they are or what they believe. The Secretary General commended the efforts of French and African Union troops here, but said they are, quote, under-resourced and overwhelmed by what he called the sheer scale of the need. Mr. Ban said he continues to push for transforming the AU troops here into a UN peacekeeping force that would include 10,000 soldiers and about 2,000 police. And look, VOA News.
Nigeria says it's overtaken South Africa as the continent's biggest economy. Statistics Chief Yemi Kale said Sunday the economy's estimated about $490 billion, topping the $384 billion the World Bank calculated for South Africa 2 years ago. But South Africa, with a smaller population, has a substantially higher per capita income. Libya's government has reached agreement with rebels to reopen two of four oil ports in a major breakthrough to win an eight-month blockade. The country's justice minister, Saleh Imrighani, said the ports will reopen in two stages. Two ports are to open right away, followed by two others in 2 to 4 weeks. The blockade has cost the government billions in lost oil revenues. At least 86 people have died in a recent Ebola outbreak in West Africa, especially Guinea, where most of the cases have been reported. There, health officials say all passengers departing the capital Conakry must fill out a health form and have their temperature taken to prevent further spread of the often fatal disease. In Ghana, health authorities are testing the blood sample from a 12-year-old girl who died of a viral fever in what would be that country's first case of Ebola. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News. Many of the stories you've heard can be found in our internet webpage, the address voanews.com.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Rwanda commemorates 20 years of genocide today, Monday.
It's very important in that we want to take stock of what has happened to us. We want to remember, we want to renew, we want to commit ourselves to our unity and look at what is coming ahead.
Businge Johnston is Rwanda's Attorney General and Minister of Justice. We'll examine how the international media covered the Rwanda massacre. Nigeria's Boko Haram is suspected of kidnapping two Italian priests and a nun in Cameroon. And Nigeria declares itself Africa's biggest economy.
Nigeria today has a $500 billion economy. That puts it as the 26th largest economy in the world. That is a phenomenal number.
Harold Dawley Jr. is the former U.S. ambassador to the African Development Bank. The trial of four detainees accused of plotting to overthrow the South Sudan government resumes today, Monday, in Juba. And a climate innovation center opens in Ethiopia. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Rwanda's Attorney General and Minister of Justice says the country has made significant strides to reconcile citizens in the past 20 years following the 1994 genocide that left about 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus killed in a 100-day massacre. Rwanda begins the commemoration of the genocide today, Monday. Businge Johnston says the commemoration of the tragedy is a period of stock-taking. Johnston tells reporter Peter Clotty that Rwanda is looking to the future with a lot of hope after what he says has been the country's economic transformation since the genocide.
It's very important in that we want to take stock of what has happened to us. We want to remember, we want to renew, we want to commit ourselves to our unity and look at what is coming ahead. What is the legacy of the genocide and all the things that happened after the genocide, like justice, like unity and reconciliation, like caring for survivors of the genocide, like giving the victims a decent burial, and also to take stock on what is happening to the world 20 years down the road. Is genocide still never again? Is it still a crime against humanity? So we are taking stock of the 20 years and looking at the future.
Now, Mr. Johnston, you made mention of unity during your answering of taking stock. And one significant thing I heard you say, it's the genocide against the Tutsis. Now, we were made to believe that the genocide occurred in Rwanda, but moderate Hutus were killed, although a majority of Tutsis were killed in that genocide. Some people are expressing concern that this does not breed unity that the government has been working so hard to achieve after these 20 long years. What do you say to that?
For us, it's giving everything its proper place. Genocide is, by definition, the intention to wipe out a particular section for a particular reason. And those who fought it, those who stood up against it, we really, really commemorate with them every Remembrance Week, if you know very well.
What lessons has Rwanda and its people learned 20 years after this very sad episode in the country's history?
What we have learned is probably what we learned immediately. In fact, even before the genocide, of course, we did not know it was the magnitude was going to be that. But we have learned that divisive politics, we have learned that an ideology that is capable of nothing else but hatred of one community against another community, of one people against another, that kind of politics, that kind of practice, that kind of ideology ends up causing you mass atrocity. And the mass atrocity that we saw in 1994 was a result of a thought and action process that preceded it many, many years, and then it culminated in 1994 genocide. So we have learned the lessons of what do we do when we are in political office, what do we say when we have the opportunity to say something to the public, what are our actions in regard to members of the public.
Businge Johnston is Rwanda's Attorney General and Minister of Justice. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Kigali. It's been 20 years since genocide claimed the lives of at least 800,000 Rwandans. As part of the commemoration of the event, VOA hosted a panel discussion focusing on long-standing criticism that international news media underreported the 1994 massacres. VOA's Robert Dagia has details.
Rwanda was in the midst of a civil war in 1994, and extremist media were encouraging ethnic hatred against minority Tutsis in the run-up to the genocide. At the same time, says Alan Thompson of Carleton University in Canada, Rwanda was a low priority for international media even after the massacres began on April the 7th.
I think international media, by its virtual absence, did contribute to those events. I think there's certainly a degree of complicity.
Thompson's point, not until several weeks into the genocide did international media really begin reporting on the killings carried out by extremist majority ethnic Hutus. Thompson, a former foreign correspondent, was speaking at a panel on media and genocide prevention at VOA headquarters in Washington. Also among the panelists was Michael Dobbs of the U.S. Holocaust Museum, who said the conflict in Bosnia-Herzegovina partly explains the media's relative lack of interest in Rwanda at the time.
The second big event was the inauguration of Nelson Mandela as president of South Africa. So all the African reporters who probably would have gone immediately to Rwanda as soon as the killings began, they were all focused on this big event in South Africa.
Mark Nelson of the Center for International Media Assistance said reporting on the genocide was just very daunting, even for seasoned and competent international reporters.
It was really difficult for everybody to figure out what to do about it. You know, for the journalists who were involved, you know, the Wall Street Journal at that time didn't have anybody in Africa except in South Africa. And it just did not seem like it was something that we could do anything about.
So what have journalists and media learned from the Rwandan genocide? Are media now better able to recognize possible warning signs of impending atrocities? Idriss Fall of VOA's French to Africa service sees similarities between the work of extremist media in Rwanda in 1994 and some newspapers in the Central African Republic today.
There is a lot of similarities, and especially when you look at the newspapers in Bangui, they don't have power radio like Milcolin. You have small papers this size, and most of them are doing a kind of insidious propaganda. So everything is there.
The widespread persecution of the Central African Republic's Muslim minority has created what the United Nations has called a pre-genocide situation. In 1994, the Rwandan genocide claimed the lives of at least 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in the space of just 3 months. Robert Daguiar, VOA News, Washington.
A U.S. investment banker says he's not surprised by the news that Nigeria has overtaken South Africa as the biggest economy in Africa. Nigerian Statistics Chief Yemi Kalu said Sunday the country's economy is estimated at about $490 billion, easily topping the $384 billion figure the World Bank calculated for South Africa in 2012. Harold Dawley Jr., former U.S. ambassador to the Africa Development Bank, tells me Nigeria, with its $500 billion economy, stands to grow even bigger once the country decides to privatize its oil and gas upstream operations.
Nigeria today has a $500 billion economy. That puts it as the 26th largest economy in the world. That is a phenomenal number. And since 2006, you've had an annual growth rate in the economy of 6%. And I believe this is only the beginning. Once Nigeria decides to privatize its oil and gas upstream operations, I believe that this will be a further boom in Nigeria. And it will attract an enormous amount of direct investment.
There's a status business here. South Africa was representing Africa at the G20. And would this place Nigeria above South Africa in terms of who represents Africa?
Well, Nigeria has 170 million people. South Africa has less than 70 million people. In just sheer numbers, Nigeria is a force to be reckoned with. Nigeria has a seat on the Security Council at the UN. It has been a good neighbor in Africa. It has worked with their neighboring countries to try and maintain peace in their region of West Africa. And it must be acknowledged that they do have some issues within their own borders in the north that they're dealing with as well.
Listening to the finance minister, there are several things that Nigeria still needs to get in place. For example, she said we need to still work hard on infrastructure, our governance, corruption.
Well, she's right, and her tenure has been quite a large part of this overall transformation, and she deserves a great deal of credit for it.
Many Nigerians say they don't feel this growth that we are talking about now, that it doesn't impact them.
With all good news, there are naysayers out there. This is good news, period. You want to show the growth in your economy, the sophistication of your economy, and being the 26th largest economy in the world, and you're producing 2.5 million barrels of oil a day at $100 a barrel. Nigeria is a force to be reckoned with, and the growth, as I said, has only begun. Once Nigeria moves to privatize its oil industry and other parastatals within the government, you will see such a flow and such a boom in the economy and in the Nigerian stock market.
Harold Dawley Jr. is the former U.S. ambassador to the Africa Development Bank. You're speaking with me from New York City. It's Monday morning and April 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. Daybreak Africa time, 17 and a half minutes past the hour. There is frustration in northern Cameroon after two Italian priests and a nun of Canadian nationality were kidnapped and whisked off to Nigeria by suspected Boko Haram members. As Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from northern Cameroon, the government has deployed heavily armed troops to the area to investigate.
Christians in northern Cameroon sing during a special mass organized to ask for God's protection. Three of their fellow believers were attacked 60 kilometers from the Nigerian area that serves as a base for the Islamist group Boko Haram. The Bishop of the Cameroon Diocese, Philip Stephens, says he does not understand why God's servants should be given such treatment.
I don't understand how two priests and a sister who work for God, who work for the people, who lie the people, and how it is possible to kidnap these people. There is no reason, no reason, and I am very sad, very sad.
Seminarian Lade Pierre witnessed the kidnapping and alerted the police. He says a group of armed men arrived shortly before midnight last Friday and ransacked church buildings before seizing the priest and nun.
Quand j'ai vu la chambre de mon curé,
I noticed the priest had been brutalized and their rooms ransacked, he says. He adds that the armed men did not leave only with the clergy.
Ils voulaient prendre la voiture de sœur.
He says the kidnappers wanted to take the vehicle of the Reverend Sister, and when it was difficult to start it, they left with a smaller vehicle. The priests, who are about 50 years old, were identified as Gianpaolo Mata and Gianantonio Allegre, and known as Gilberte Brussier. Father Mata had been in Cameroon for more than 6 years, while Father Allegre had arrived around a year ago. 70-year-old Reverend Sister Gilberte has been in Cameroon for nearly 4 decades and was soon to be evacuated to her native Canada for prolonged ill health. The priest had been working on improving water supplies and fighting the spread of HIV/AIDS. Cameroon Minister of Defense Edgar Aleme Bengo went to northern Cameroon and ordered investigations to determine who was responsible for the attack. The local population already blames Boko Haram, which has carried out several kidnappings in the region during the past year. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Marwa, North Cameroon.
In South Sudan, the trial of four senior political detainees accused of trying to overthrow President Salva Kiir is scheduled to resume today, Monday. As Charlton Doki reports from Juba, four prosecution witnesses failed to once again appear in court on Friday.
The prosecution was expected to produce its four unnamed witnesses, all of them security operatives, to testify against former SPLM Secretary General Pagan Amum Okech, former Security Minister Oyaideng Ajak, former Deputy Defense Minister Majak Dagot Atem, and the former head of mission to the U.S., Ezekiel Lol Gatkoth. None of them showed up, and lead prosecutor James Mayen says he doesn't know where they are.
We've been looking for them, and they have just disappeared in the town. So we have consulted the relevant units in the army, but their whereabouts is not known.
The prosecution asked the court to allow them to drop the four men from the list of witnesses. Defense counsel Kur Lual did not object, and the five-judge panel granted the request. But the judges denied the prosecution's request to allow them to play an audio recording of a conversation between the suspects on that night in mid-December when the violence broke out in Juba. Following a half-hour consultation, the judges ruled the recording could be played on one condition. Here again is lead prosecutor Mayen.
The main ruling is that we are asked to produce before the court the very person that recorded the... we are going to sit and decide on it.
Lead defense counsel Monyiluak Alor welcomed the court's ruling.
The court was right because there are likely to be questions, especially from the defense, so he must be cross-examined. So now we are not sure whether they will be able to bring that person. If they don't bring that person on Monday, their case is closed.
While he could not say the prosecution's case is in deep trouble, he is confident the accused will be found not guilty of treason.
I wouldn't say it has collapsed. If it was collapsed, it would have been thrown out. But it has always been very weak. So it is even weaker. But we are optimistic.
The defense team is expected to present its witnesses next week. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
The Ethiopia Climate Innovation Center opened recently in Addis Ababa, where the hub aims to support businesses and entrepreneurs searching for clean energy and climate change solutions. The World Bank-sponsored project is just one of eight centers planned. The next center is scheduled to be built in Ghana. Business incubation specialist with the centers, Michael East, talks to Ricky Stryak about some of the ways that the center hopes to create both jobs and clean energy.
And the idea is that developing countries are going to be the hardest hit by climate change, but at the same time, there's an opportunity for developing countries to benefit their local industries.
In Ethiopia, agriculture in the country makes up about 46% of the GDP. Fluctuations in rainfall have been affecting agriculture all over sub-Saharan Africa recently. How is the Climate Center hoping to address this issue?
The rainfall patterns change. They decline in some places and go up in others. In Ethiopia, it may actually increase because it's scheduled to get warmer. But agriculture that's rain-fed depends on very consistent rainfall patterns. And when they change, farmers are immediately impacted. So technologies such as solar-powered irrigation, drip irrigation, can really help farmers adapt for low cost to these climate change challenges within agriculture.
It's also looking at ways that normal households in Ethiopia can decrease their energy consumption. The making of injera, which is the bread Ethiopians, I think, mostly eat on a daily basis, if not twice daily basis, it says it accounts for 90% of all household energy consumption. One local entrepreneur developed an efficient biogas stove that could reduce the wood consumption needed for injera. So the center will be looking for developments like that then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the 90% of household energy use is both from the entrepreneur. So just to be clear, we haven't validated that. But yeah, traditional cooking methods are both dirty and unsafe for the folks that do the cooking. And they also create a lot of deforestation because traditional wood biomass stoves people just get firewood from the local forests. So if you can use a different type of biomass, biogas, to power these stoves, you can really save a lot of forest. The amount of emissions coming from forest degradation is large. Actually, it's by degrading forests, they're not absorbing CO2 like they used to. You can power stoves, you can power lanterns from a variety of sources, including compost from agricultural waste.
Michael East is a business incubation specialist with the Ethiopia Climate Center. He was speaking with Ricky Shrek from Accra, Ghana. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Hosts Chad pipped Libya 1-0 in N'Djamena as Kenya and Tanzania drew 0-0 and Gambia edged Liberia 1-0 in African Youth Championship qualifiers on Sunday. Earlier on Saturday, Swaziland thrashed Lesotho 3-0. Ethiopia beat Seychelles 2-0. Sierra Leone edged Guinea 1-0. Niger outplayed Congo Brazzaville 2-0. Mozambique pipped Namibia 2-1. Tunisia thrashed Mauritania 3-0, while Djibouti and Burundi drew 1-1, as did Malawi and Botswana. Turning to athletics, Ethiopian multiple long-distance world record holder Kenenisa Bekele stormed back into the limelight of world athletics when he triumphed at the Paris Marathon in France on Sunday. Bekele won his debut marathon in 2 hours, 5 minutes and 3 seconds. Kenyan Flomena Cheyech won the women's race in 2 hours, 22 minutes and 44 seconds. In South Korea, Ethiopian Yamane Tsegei Adane clocked 2 hours, 6 minutes and 51 seconds to win the Daegu Marathon on Sunday. After finishing second in the women's event in the past 2 years, Ethiopia's Mulu Seboka finally carried the day in 2 hours, 25 minutes and 23 seconds. Elsewhere, Kenyans were in dominant form. Francis Kiprop and Vicelyne Jepkesho triumphed in the men's and women's contest at the Milan Marathon in Italy. In Britain, William Chebor set the men's course record of 2 hours, 9 minutes and 25 seconds as Alice Cercer Milgo won the women's race at the Brighton Marathon. While in Ireland, Japheth Corir clocked 29 minutes and 12 seconds to win the men's contest at the Great Dublin 10-kilometer run. Earlier on Saturday, Kenyan Joyce Chepkurui set a course record of 1 hour, 6 minutes and 19 seconds in the women's race at the Prague International Marathon in the Czech Republic. Her winning time is a 29-second improvement over the mark set by fellow Kenyan Gladys Cherono last year. Chepkurui is now the fifth fastest female ever in the event. Finally, in taekwondo, Nigerian All-Africa Games gold medalist Uchu Chukwumerije outclassed Hicham Masaoudi of Germany to win the middleweight title at the Belgian Open Championships in Lommel on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Rwanda's government has reiterated remarks that France played a direct role in the genocide 20 years ago that resulted in the deaths of nearly 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus at the hands of ethnic Hutu militias. And Nigeria says it has overtaken South Africa as the biggest economy in Africa. That's it for this Monday, April 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing every one of you a very good day in Africa. But please stay tuned for International Edition next.
Do you love African music?
Music time in Africa. Wake, 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 wake,
wake. Umaru, wake. This is Heather Maxwell, and if you do, Music Time in Africa is the perfect show for you. Tune in to listen on the radio Saturdays and Sundays at 0900, 2000 and 2100 UTC. You can also listen to the show day or night on the internet. Go to voanews.com and voaafrica.com and click on Music Time in Africa. You'll find past and present radio shows and a link to my blog, African Music Treasures. This is Africa, through its own music. oldies, classics, traditional music, Afropop, and fusion. You get it all right here in one beautiful bundle on VOA's Music Time in Africa.